Production, in fact, maybe in the whole talk, I'm not sure that I'll say anything really new that you haven't heard many times before. But as Dennis Chiama once said, in fact, I think it was in a talk on black holes, and he said this, there's nothing that a good physicist likes better than to be told something that they already know very well. That's somewhat of the spirit of the talk. And that's true. The talk will have sort of three parts, the middle one being just the talk that I was going to give, and other layers of the sandwich being the ones in response to Rob's request. So first, I'll just talk on a little bit of the history of the subject, just as I remember it myself, really, not in any systematic way. And then the 10 theses. And then finally, a list of some questions that come out of this that might be worth doing, some of which I think actually are doable. So despite what Dennis Chiama said, I will try to emphasize some aspects that I think are unjustly neglected often, and those are specifically the what I might call the non-equilibrium aspects of the subject. So, for example, the reason not only to understand why entropy has the value that it has, but why the generalized second law holds, in other words, why the entropy increases with time. And similarly, another example of this is fluctuations of quantities associated with the horizon and the black hole. So, in planning the talk this way, I will be neglecting vast aspects that people here are familiar with, and I'm sure will be coming up over and over again at the conference. So, for example, I'll have very little to say about the AdS-CFT dualities, which are clearly some of the most interesting things that have come out of recent work on the subject. So let's start with the historical part. Some of the earliest evidence for the thermodynamic nature of the black hole was from what were called at that time the Noether theorems. And specifically, they were theorems on the decay of perturbations of the black hole solutions back to the pure black hole solution. What they showed in one way of looking at it is that these were done, of course, just in linear perturbation theory at the time. Now we can actually see this decay in the full nonlinear glory in computer simulations, but the general character was already clear from looking at the linear situation. And what it shows in one way of looking at it is that the black hole, or if you prefer, the horizon of the black hole, is a highly dissipated system. It settles back down to its ground state or its equilibrium state remarkably quickly. People often talk about a ring down, but if you could hear it, if you look at the waveforms, you only see one or two cycles of the wave before it damps out. So if you could hear it, it wouldn't sound anything like a pure bell. It would sound, I don't know, like a mush. Sometimes I think a bell is not a good analogy. A better one might be a marshmallow when it settles down. So it's a highly dissipated object, and also not only the Noether theorems, which were concentrated on the rate at which different multiples went back to zero, but also on the quasi-normal modes, which came up in this time, also showed very clearly because one sees the dampings in those as well. So that was the first suggestion. The second suggestion that pointed in the direction of a thermodynamic interpretation was the very small number of parameters that characterize an equilibrium solution, or in other words, a stationary solution of the Einstein equation. In the case of a pure black hole, a pure gravity, an isolated black hole, there's just the mass, the angular momentum. In the case it's not at rest, we could add also its velocity. But aside from that, there's nothing. There's it could be said, I mean, this is for an isolated black hole. In the context of the Noether theorems, there were some confusions, I think, that it meant that no solution involving a black hole could have other than these three or something very close to them. That, of course, is not right, because you could, for example, just build a cage around the black hole, and if you included enough fields and so on to describe the cage, and that would produce some kinds of distortions. That would be something analogous to maybe putting a perfect gas in a magnetic field and distorting its equilibrium. But for an isolated black hole, there's these very few number of parameters, and that's also very strongly reminiscent of thermodynamic systems in equilibrium, where if you macroscopic parameters describe everything about the equilibrium state. And of course, the next probably important piece of evidence were the so-called four laws of black hole, as it was called then, released in this widely read paper by Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking that described these. They called them the four laws of black hole mechanics, not wanting to go out on a limb and say that it was thermodynamics, but the analogy was, of course, with thermodynamics. And there are four of them, just like in thermodynamics. But the most, although I think the third law, and the third law, I guess, insofar as we have it, came later, I think, and with the work of Werner Israel. But that comes from looking at perturbations of these quantities about the equilibrium solution. Now we can actually write the law for arbitrary perturbations, but at that time it was just perturbations to other equilibrium solutions, so just remaining within the equilibrium manifold. And of course, as everyone is familiar, it said that the change in the mass or energy is neural, but it is if the velocity is small to avoid having a more complicated formula. And then kappa, the surface gravity, times the change in area divided by 8 pi g. So this is just coming from perturbing the Einstein equations, but of course, in the spirit of the analogy, if you look at it, you can identify these terms, rewrite it like this. We can identify on the left-hand side what looks like the typical work terms. This is just imparting some angular momentum. This is setting the black hole in motion. And then there's a non-mechanical term here, which is left over, and which, as in thermodynamics, is an exact differential, or in other words, a closed or an exact form on the space, the manifold of solutions, where this is the so-called surface gravity, which is an acceleration in roughly proportional to 1 over the radius of the hole. So in comparison with thermodynamics suggests that this is the heat flow term. Indeed, there's no mechanical way that you can just grab a hold of the horizon and stretch it out, and still less can you press it in. So it even looked at this stage as if it was a non-reversible process, because the Hawking radiation wasn't known yet. And so, but it was very tempting to say, well, this looks like it ought to be a sort of TDS, temperature times change in entropy. But of course, the area is not dimensionless as an entropy should be. And you can make it dimensionless by multiplying and dividing by h bar, and then you get dA over 8 pi g. Of course, you don't know what multiple of h bar to put in there, but if you just put in the unit multiple, which turns out to be the right answer, ultimately, then this just last term, this ds term, then is just the change in A divided by L squared, where L is the Planck length. So L is in these units. This didn't used to be so popular. Units that I like to use, but now it's cosmology, they're very popular. So, speaking of cosmology, so in those units, the equation looks like this. and the expression for the attribute looks like that. So that was the next big piece of evidence. And then, of course, the other very compelling piece of evidence was the area law. If this is really an entropy, then it ought to make some sort of law around decrease or increase with time. And if this h bar is in there, then the classical limit in which h bar goes to zero, this contribution to the entropy ought to dominate everything else. And so one would expect that the area of the horizons taken alone ought to increase. And that, of course, was the area increase. That was also proved. The area increase law, which said that the area, again, in these units of Laplace length, since it goes to infinity, as h, I'm just repeating what I just said, since it goes to infinity as h bar goes to zero, it ought to increase. In fact, there have been earlier indications of something that nature is supposed to do, called the invariant mass, that at certain processes never decrease. It turned out to be basically a measure of the area. So in full generality, we have this law, which is the classical analog of the non-decreasing character of the entropy. So everything was fitting together, except, of course, that the temperature seemed to still be zero, and that was taken care of by the Hawking radiation, which showed that there was the black hole did have a genuine physical temperature, and it pinned down the exact coefficient that one needed to put in here to get the temperature right. One last piece of evidence was the computation of the partition function, the gravitational partition function, from doing a Euclidean, doing a path integral calculation after a Wick rotation in the way that is familiar in statistical mechanics. And that also gave a value for the partition function, for the free energy, and then for the temperature of the black hole that was consistent with all of this. So this is from the gravitational function. Since this is just historical at this point, I wanted to say just a little bit about my personal reaction to all of these things. At first, I hadn't been particularly following it too closely, but after I realized that there was really something interesting there, that really the black hole was a thermodynamic system, two questions popped up. The first question was, well, if this is a thermodynamic system, what do you do with open a textbook of thermodynamics? Well, we better put it in a box and see what happens. So you put it in you can do that, and you get some interesting results about the different possible equilibrium. One, the most interesting probably, is that if you make the box too big, the equilibrium becomes unstable. This is related to the negative specific heat of the black hole. That is the equilibrium that has the black hole, and it becomes unstable in its equilibrium with the surrounding radiation. There's another equilibrium state, which is the more stable one, in which the black hole completely disappears, or gets much bigger, but say completely disappears and you have only radiation. So there are multiple equilibrium states, quasi-equilibrium states, and everything in the end is not too surprising. It goes about the way you would expect, although some people, especially Roger Penrose, tried to draw some very surprising conclusions by studying the process of fluctuation from one equilibrium state to another. In particular, he suggested one might see violations of CPT invariants in this process, and that you might see actual violations in the sense of actual wave function collapse. There's a whole story there. But if you just look at this without taking it too far afield, it's not too surprising, and I think you could say it's understood fairly well. My second thought, though, was, well, this is strange. Why is the black hole, why is the entropy proportional to the area? We know that entropy can be measured in information units, and if we do it that way, then what this is telling us is that the horizon carries roughly one bit of information per unit area, where unit area is Planck area. So this is, must be, so if you imagine very, just metaphorically, the horizon divided into little plaquettes of plant size, each one is carrying about one bit of information. But what is this, what is the carrier of this information? So that was a question that arose at that time. And, I think maybe Rob would agree on that too, based on his introduction, that we still don't really have the answer to that, although maybe we're making progress towards it. So certainly, I don't, never felt that I found the full answer, but it's something that occupied my thoughts a lot. So what carries the information? Well, I think I'll write this down again, actually. So as it could have been, one thing that appealed to me at the time was, in a sort of effective description, would be fluctuations in the shape of the horizon itself, something geometrical that goes with the geometrical nature of the entropy. Another possibility was entanglement that I worked on. And the other question, of course, that came up at that time, and that was just the one I've been stressing a little bit, is why does the entropy increase? I mean, after all, we understand something about increase of entropy in general, but here we're doing something funny. We're throwing away all the entropy of everything that goes inside the black hole and just attributing a certain value to it independently of what was thrown in. Why should that, when added to the entropy of the external region, necessarily be increasing with time or non-decreasing? So a few other puzzles arose at that time. Some of, not all of them resolved still, I think. One of them, maybe this is resolved, but I don't know the resolution myself, maybe someone can tell me, is how is it that we can do this calculation of the partition function in a formalism which assumes, which assumes an expression like this for the equilibrium state where this thing doesn't converge, because for the black hole, corresponding to its negative specific heat, the density of states grows so rapidly that this can never converge for any finite temperature. Yet we seem to be able to compute it and get a reasonable answer. So what's going on there? Another thing that arose, puzzles that arose, were entropy bounds coming from the Duncan experiments, I guess first proposed by Jacob Ekenstein, in which one lowers or drops objects into the black hole and assumes that the generalized second law holds. This is, of course, called the generalized second law, the fact that the total entropy computed in this way is now decreasing. That seems to put limits on the amount of entropy that can fall in, and so limits on the amount of entropy that can be present. So that was the first of these many entropy bounds. No object of a certain size and a certain mass can have more than a certain entropy. That led...
Could I ask a question on this?
What? Yeah.
I'm just curious, there's the species issues with that particular bound. If you have too many species, you can have more entropy for the same energy. Do you know what the status of that? Do people understand how to correct the Bekenstein, the black hole thing, which doesn't depend on the number of species, and the actual Bekenstein bound, which does depend on the number of species?
Right, yeah, the species problem also comes up in connection with entanglement entropy. And then, right. In fact, I was going to raise that as a question. But so I think the answer is it's not completely, it remains controversial. So some people, and this was the next thing I was going to mention, that Bob Wald and Phil Unruh argued against the universality of this term. They, and in fact, I was also involved in some of those discussions. And in fact, I mentioned this, I brought up this thing that you mentioned, the apparent counterexample of the number of species. And, their point of view would be that you can break the bound that way, and other effects come in to guarantee the generalized second law. Basically, that if you tried to, if you had an object of this size, of this sort, a typical thing would be some massive particle that could have an infinite or a very large number of internal states, if you like different flavors, different species. Suppose you drop one into the black hole, it would seem that the total entropy of the world would go down. The counter argument would be because there are all these different species, there would be different fields associated, say, an effective field for each one of these species. And so this thing would be very copiously radiated, because the phase space for it would be very, very large. And it would find that it's radiated more rapidly than the time you were dropping in, and others would come out. That would be kind of counterargument.
Right. So that part works out beautiful, right? I mean, the black hole never suffers by the species problem just because of radiation.
Yeah.
But still, if you try to connect the two bounds to each other, you might have something.
Well, the bound would be full. In that field, the bound itself would be full. So there are two questions. One is the bound, I mean, you can pose the questions in two ways. Is the bound true in itself as a universal bound in any conceivable theory that's consistent that includes gravity? The second question is the bound true in the real world in the theory? It describes the world we live in. And
maybe Herman could say something about, is it possible to make Calabi-Yau manifolds in string theory with arbitrary complexity so you can get an arbitrary number of species, or is there a limit to that?
Yeah, I was about to bring this up, but in principle one cannot, at least in the principle of black holes, decouple the number of species from actual properties of black holes, which to me actually was one of the striking things of the results of Brains and ASCFT, that one cannot just start changing the compactification and expect that the lower dimensional physics remains the same, that Newton's constant doesn't change if I change the number of species. So I think at least with black holes, those things tend to hang together.
So you can't just make an arbitrary number of massless, non-interacting, or close non-interacting species by taking arbitrary complicated Calabi-Yau.
You could do that, but then effectively you're getting a large negative cosmological constant in four dimensions that would essentially create some ADS curvature that would make it all work out. So at least those kind of things, at least in a lot of cases that people understand hang together, but still, it's an interesting question. If, for example, you could have a large number of species in a flat space-time with a certain fixed value of the constant, and then you change these kind of puzzles.
Mm. Yeah, there's a related thing for entanglement entropy too, where if all are part of the black hole's entropy is being entangled, then talking about the fields, propagating in the black hole back. And again, if you change the number of species, you would think you could change the entropy entirely. And yet we know it has one particular value, which is essentially geometrical. There again, the counter thought is, well, but if we change the number of species, that also renormalizes the gravitational constant. And there's a strong suggestion that the renormalization is exactly such as to compensate for change in the entropy. So it looks the same formula because it has G in it. Same formula looks true. That's another question I want to raise at the end. What is the status of that? Do we know that that's right? Is it wrong? It's been questioned in the case of fermionic fields in particular.
Which status, right?
Whether the normal, there's some argument that the normalization has the wrong side in the case of fermionic fields, and so we can't preserve this relationship.
So for example, if you had equal number of bosons and fermions, the G would not be normalized at all, then you have a problem. Is that what you said?
No, they said, this is just from hearsay, but the claim is that G would be normalized, but it would go the wrong way. So it couldn't preserve. That's a question I want to raise. Maybe people know the status of this. I don't. As I said, I haven't been working on this recently.
An unrelated, perhaps somewhat also misleading comments, but it just struck me again that in the place where you introduce the entropy and the temperature, it touched in an H bar to make it work. Yes. Whereas the formula started out as being classical and then suddenly looks like it. And that seems to be sort of something that happens more often. For example, beta times H, beta Hawking times H bar times the energy, but right, the energy is H bar omega. Again, H bar drops out of that formula. So maybe, for example, the Unruh effect, or as it's usually thought of as a quantum phenomenon, is actually a classical phenomenon, in the sense that the rate for emission is just e to the minus the acceleration times the frequency. an H bar drops out of it. So, and it's essentially the same physics that leads to the radiation due to charge, which is a classic one. So there's sometimes actually these kind of things that look quantum, and where the H bar actually drops out of the actual physical effect. I'm not sure.
That's what for black
hole. That's unit, isn't it? Just units. I mean, I can always stick it in there. Classical entropy doesn't an H bar. It's just a matter of units. And doesn't have any effect with an H bar into the entropy formula.
Yeah, it's just, right. H bar enters into classical statistical mechanics because of. But still, there's a difference between an effect that is actually a quantum effect that really disappears when H bar goes to zero, whatever that means, but an effect that just are purely.
For example, black hole evaporation time does have an H bar, right? So it's m times m over H bar, sorry, m over m Planck whole square. So there you can't take the H bar out.
Yeah, yes. I'm not claiming that everything is classical, but it's sometimes there are situations where the H bar drop seems to drop out, and I'm not sure that at that point it's meaningful. But again, Hund-Rudolf radiation in principle could be understood, should be able to understand classical point.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I think that there's no doubt that the entropy itself is a quantum. This first law, or this relationship, is not as
classical.
It's some sort of classical. And I think typically in macroscopic limits of things, sometimes constants drop out.
Again, I'm not saying that. It's just a thought.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. So. Well, another puzzle that came at this time was the self-accelerating. This one, I think, has been larger. It was a spin-off, just mentioning it. It was a spin-off of this discussion of entropy bounds. So in this analysis that Bill and Bob did of the Jacob's argument was lowering a box full of some highly entropic substance into a black hole. And they tried to analyze this, and they noticed basically, if you like, because of the Unruh effect, that the box appears to experience some sort of buoyancy that would hold, prevent it from being lowered down into the black hole. But there's a confusion that comes from, but does it really? Because if you take it seriously, what it's telling you is that because of the box, the idea is that the box, when it's lowered into the field of the black hole, is accelerating, but in order to keep it from falling in, it has to be accelerating upward. And because it's accelerating, one way of thinking of it is because it's accelerating, it feels a temperature, but because the two top and bottom of the box are at different heights, they feel a different temperature. They're in bath, as if they're in a bath of thermal radiation. And the one at the bottom feels more temperature because it's accelerating more. There's a black hole. And so it feels a kind of buoyancy force. But this has nothing to do with the black hole, it's just a statement of the acceleration. So then you start thinking, well, I could start accelerating the box. When I get it up to a sufficiently large acceleration, it'll do the buoyancy force, and it'll just accelerate forever. Without that, I can just let go of it, and it'll just keep accelerating. That's a little bit nerve-wracking, if that could be true. Then we have to ask, why isn't the vacuum full of all these boxes? Which is a very high entropy state. So anyway, so there's an answer to that, I think. I wasn't going to talk about it, which is that in fact there's another effect, which is the heating up of the walls of the box that compensates it. But that's a puzzle, another puzzle that arose at this time. And then, of course, the puzzle that everyone talks about, which is the unitarity puzzle. I don't even have to talk about it. Sometimes people call it information loss puzzle. And that's the statement that if that's just thinking of a situation in which a black hole is formed somehow, a kind of S matrix setup, you just throw in stuff, make a black hole, wait for it to evaporate, stuff comes out, is the description of that overall process as it appears to be non-unitary if we take the point of view of someone the black hole. So these were various puzzles that arose. As I said, I don't think, as Rob also said, are not all resolved yet. And if I just summarize them into one big question, I would say it's this. What is the statistical mechanics of the black hole thermodynamics. Showed that for thermodynamics. In particular, so we're used to whatever the thermodynamics, we're used to statistical mechanics underneath it. So the thermodynamics was the classical theory. The detailed description of the underlying physics would be the statistical mechanics. And two or three big questions come up. What is the entropy of the horizon counting? Second of all, both in and out of equilibrium. I want to emphasize that too. In keeping with my example, I emphasize the non-equilibrium and more neglected aspect. Out of equilibrium, there's also a question. So remember the law of the increase of the area. This is not just a law for small perturbations, quasi-stationary. It's a completely general law. It includes cases in which there wouldn't be even a black hole present in the normal sense of the word, but there'd be a horizon. For example, if a shell collapses, then in the early stages of the collapse, well, throughout the collapse, within the shell, you just have flat space. And the horizon forms inside at the center of the shell and expands outward in the time in which the space-time is still flat. And that it does so completely consistent with the area. But there's no curvature there at that time. So that's a very non-equilibrium situation. I think it's important to understand the origin of the entropy in that situation, too. For example, shell collapse. And then, ultimately, of course, the question is this, when we find the underlying degrees of freedom, are they going to actually lead us to the constituents of space-time, and what are they? I would want to say causal set elements. Many people might say string, although I don't know if you can call a string a constituent of space-time, but something like that, maybe a loop in loop quantum gravity, I'm not sure. They're a little bit halfway because you have background space-times in both those cases. So the other big question is why does the generalized second law hold? To pose the question in a slightly different way, what's the mechanism of dissipation that drives you to equilibrium that was seen in those early no-hair theorems that I've talked about? Is it more subsidiary question to that? Can we view the black hole or the horizon, as I would tend to think, rather than the black hole itself? Can we view the horizon as a dynamical system in its own right? If so, maybe in some effective sense, not necessarily in terms of these fundamental variables, but in some effective sense, can we view it as a dynamical system? And what, if so, what are the variables that describe it, and presumably we would need a cutoff to handle the fact that this is only an effective description. It's only good above the cutoff. And we use that then, for example, to count the entropy states. I'll raise a question about an analogy with a perfect gas later that I think would make a nice problem to work on. And then the third question that I emphasize, what fluctuations arise from the underlying statistical mechanics? That's another familiar fact. In a thermodynamic description, fluctuations are not seen, but some of the best evidence in the way of making contact with the underlying statistical mechanics is looking for the fluctuations. In this case, it could be, for example, fluctuations in the shape of the horizon.
Can I ask a small question about point one? I think GR people, I think maybe Ashtaker was doing this, define many kinds of horizons, right? And
that's right. There are
which
many
kind
sides.
Of horizon is the one that you want
so
to
I was going, yeah, so I was going to save time, not talk about it. So when I say horizon, I always mean event horizon.
So these are not local concepts, then. And these are the ones you think should be
global concepts.
And these are the ones you want to attach physical meaning to.
Sorry,
you think this is the one that should have physical meaning.
I think this is the
other ones.
To me, this is the So that's a long discussion. I don't know of any notion of horizon that's completely local. They're all global to some extent, but this is certainly the most global. some of them can be detected given global information on a hypersurface. This, you need the whole space time, a large transfer space in order to detect. But you're right, there are different notions of variety.
Or there can just be spaces where those spheres are not
shaped. The area law that was proved for the event horizon and not for the other horizons. Okay, so that was the historical part. The talk that I was going to give without this was the species. So this is just presenting my own point of view on the ghosting, and if I have a little time at the end, I'll try to list some of the problems, get some interesting problems one can look at. So some of these species I've already basically exposed in what I said before. The first one is that the most natural explanation in the area law, not necessarily the only, but the most natural explanation is that the entropy resides on the horizon. So, in other words, it's quite worth writing, it's so familiar, but I'll just try to tell you. This is Boltzmann's W for the number of states. Does anyone know, by the way, why we chose W? Is that why should I need to try this? Anyway, I don't know. So W for the number of states. If that's true, then if there's a sort of one bit of information for your area, the number of possible configurations is 2 to the A. So the log of W, which is the entropy, is something called A log 2. Of course, we don't take the 2 seriously. It's just trying to show the general idea. That's why I put this in quotes. But there should be roughly one bit of information for horizon area. And then that would explain immediately why we have an area. That's the first one. I don't think controversial. Although maybe it is controversial. Some people want to say that the entropy is not on the horizon, but inside. The second point, which just repeats what I said before, is what these bits really represent depends on the deep structure, underlying structure physics, which in this case is the deep structure of space-time itself. And something most naturally just conceived of as discrete. Why is that? Well, think of an analogy with a box of gas. So in a box of gas, we can have an analogy that the entropy is equal to ultimately just counting the number of constituents of the gas. If you write down, for say, a non-degenerate gas, the function for the entropy, sorry, it's n, the proportion of gas, n is the number of molecules in that gas, and then it's n times some sort of function of the volume, the pressure, theta monatomic gas, the volume, the pressure, h bar, seems to be in here, and the mass of the constituents of the gas. But the first approximation is just counting, and the fact that the entropy of the gas is finite is ultimately a statement that the number, it's a statement of the atomicity of matter, that the number of constituents of the gas is finite. So one might expect something very similar for a black hole, that ultimately these finiteness of the entropy is due to the finiteness of the number of constituents of the horizon, or therefore of space-time itself.
You about W, it's not approved, but according to Wikipedia, it's the first kind of
question. It is? Oh, all right. They know everything. Must be right. So just write that in. Okay. So that's interesting, because that means you had a probabilistic interpretation already.
The actual equation S is K log W was Planck's equation, not Boltzmann. The one that's on his grave is actually not because K was called Planck's constant in the days of
Planck. Oh, I see. K Boltzmann was actually Planck's constant. So who decided to put it on his grid? Would you like it? Maybe Planck. So what did he write on that? That's strange because I thought Todd didn't believe in that, at least for a long time. So it was sort of one time.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Planck, yeah. Constant that Planck does now call Planck's constant. At that time, that he wrote a paper in which later on we extracted Planck's constant. This other constant, and that happens.
So this raises a question. This will be one of the questions. Can we carry this farther and actually understand the entropy of a gas in some sort of effective description? Analogous to what we'd like to do for the black hole. That is, this is just a big question. I've done a little work on this. I think there's some hope for it. If we could, it would make a nice warm-up or a toy model for trying to do the same for the quantum set. It would be encouragement for this point of view. Could we just take a fluid description of the gas, count degrees of freedom somehow, and compute and end up with the entropy in some effective description that we had a cutoff corresponding at the interatomic spacing. Anyway, so the positive point is this. So what the bits represent depends on the deep structure of space-time, most naturally conceived of as discrete. The third thesis, which just repeats something I've said before, is that if this is right, then there are two main tasks. One is to, they're just written over there. Anyway, identify the bits. What is the material basis of the information? What's the carrier of the information? And the second one, will it reveal the deep structure of space-time? And the second thing is why S increases. And as I keep harping on, I think that's the decisive one, because entropy is that, if it's anything, it's something which increases. If it doesn't increase, it's not entropy. Fourth and fifth pieces, maybe so far most people would agree with these, actually. The fourth and fifth pieces is, can go together, the idea that the entropy is inside the black hole is wrong, and the dissipative nature of the horizon precludes an appeal to unitarity. Improving the entropy increase. So let me say something about this. This will be, of course, the most controversial one. So why is the idea that the entropy, what's wrong with the idea that the entropy is inside the black hole as opposed to outside, of course, or on more reasonably on the horizon or in the neighborhood of the price? The first and most obvious thing is that if you really take that seriously, you should say that the entropy of the black hole is infinite. Why is that? Well, then, remember how entropy works. You're supposed to take the total phase space available to the system, given the macroscopic equilibrium parameters, in this case, the mass and angular momentum and so on, and measure that volume of phase space, or that dimension of Hilbert space, and that gives the entropy. But because of the possibility of space-time curvature, there's no limit to be what could be inside the black hole. I mean, if the black hole is formed in a certain way, we may know what's likely to be inside. But if we think of it as an equilibrium system, we have to take the whole available phase space. And among those are what are called the Oppenheimer-Steiger solutions, which look like a black hole outside. But inside, they look like an arbitrarily large Friedman universe patched onto a section of this rug. And so this would be an infinite number of states. And so we would get the wrong answer. That's perhaps the most obvious difficulty with the idea that the entropy is inside. The second, just this formal argument, is that when you go back to the computation of the entropy and the Euclidean path integral, you notice something interesting, which is that the Euclidean isostructural solution doesn't have a region inside the horizon. The whole of the solution corresponds to R greater than 2m. It is outside the horizon. So that's just a formal indication, maybe, that the entropy is not coming from inside the horizon. And then I'll give another argument in a second connecting to the.
So Rabbit, for this point, it's not that you're saying there is no entropy in the inside the horizon.
No,
you're saying the entropy we care about is entropy on the horizon.
Exactly.
And that's all we care about.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not saying that there's no entropy inside the horizon at all. I'm saying the entropy that enters into the generalized second law, that thing which when added to the entropy of the external matter, is supposed to increase with time, which is the entropy we care about in that sense, is on the horizon.
So care about, somehow we're talking about a set of observers who are interacting with the black hole.
Yeah,
and,
we're just trying to. Yes, I think you could say it that way. We're just saying we're trying to understand why the generalized second law holds. The generalized second law doesn't refer explicitly to anything inside the black hole. That was sort of the thing puzzle that I worried about originally. Why should there be such a law? Why can we throw away the entropy of large parts of the universe and nevertheless get some sort of law of entropy?
So this would be compatible with the idea of actually losing information if you throw something in and the radiation comes out, because lots of place inside. The entropy inside is unbounded, is that what you're saying?
Yes. The entropy in the sense of the available phase space is unbounded. Which is not the entropy that goes into the generalized second law, which is bounded, which is given by the error. So the second point, so I see I'm not even getting as far as I thought. Well, there have been some discussion.
No, well, I'll give you some extra time. You did that.
Because I did the other.
Yeah, you did
that. Every war, okay, thank you. I'm going to do the question after, which is maybe next. Okay, so let's look how a proof of entropy increase would look on some two views, the one that assumes unitarity and the one that does not assume unitarity. I'll start with the one that assumes unitarity. And now there are two sort of, if we're talking about entropy increase, in the case of a unitary system, we know that strictly speaking, if we define entropy in the usual way, as this trace rho log rho, it can't change in a unitary system. So in order to see increase, we need to do some sort of coarse graining. Okay. Well, what coarse graining means, of course, to neglect the microstates of the black hole once you decide what the microstates are. And here, then there's going to be two ways to go, which is related to the question, where is the entropy? If it's interior, you get one trend of thought. If it's on the horizon or in the neighborhood of the horizon, we get another line of argument. So let's suppose that it's in the interior. This is going to be the other argument against why it could be in the interior. We need, first of all, the black hole plus the exterior. In other words, the whole world evolves unitarily. U of his theorem holds, if you like. Second of all, we need some sort of weak coupling between the interior, the black hole, and the exterior, in order that we can make the entropy be additive and the energy be additive. Second, more than third, very important, we need at least a partial kind of equilibrium for the interior in order that these few parameters, gas and so on, these few macroscopic externally visible parameters be able to be a complete description of the equilibrium state. It better be an equilibrium. We also need ergodicity of some form, at least in the traditional proofs, again for the interior. If we have all of these things, then run out of space. Then we conclude that I'm just rehearsing here the usual argument for entropy increase in statistical mechanics. We conclude that the dwell time, in other words, the time that imagine the system point moving in phase space represents the state of the interior, the black hole, which is the black hole from this point of view, that the dwell time is proportional to the volume in phase space, or in other words, the total number of states available. And then it becomes very, very likely that if it spends the vast majority of this time in some region where n is large, then it's going to go and happens to find itself in a region where n is small, it'll soon find itself in a region in which n is larger. So that implies that this n total, by n total I mean the number of states of that region of phase space, is increasing. So this is just, I'm just reviewing the usual plausibility arguments that lead to the second law. So does this work for the black hole interior? No. Unitarity we can take as an assumption. What about partial equilibrium? Is the interior of the black hole in equilibrium? Well, it certainly doesn't look like it. It looks like, from all we know of the interior, you have a very rapid collapse to something that we don't understand, singularity. It doesn't look like equilibrium at all. Maybe it goes out into another universe. Who knows what happens? Is it ergodic? Again, it doesn't look at all ergodic as far as we can follow the evolution. We don't see signs of that. And then what about weak coupling? Well, it's not the coupling is very peculiar for a black hole. There's a asymmetry here. The coupling from outside to inside is very strong. Anything that drops in immediately, it's an obvious sense. It's not a weak coupling. And the coupling from inside to outside is either zero, at least classically it's zero, in which case how could the interior possibly be relevant? Or it's very, very ultra weak, exponentially weak in quantum theory. So it's just none of these assumptions seem to work to take it to be the interior. Degrees of freedom to be in the interior. On the other hand, if you take them to be on the horizon or the vicinity of the horizon, then everything, these counter arguments are there. There is arguably some sort of weak coupling between the horizon vicinity and what's more outside. The horizon is in a kind of equilibrium. That's this dissipation I was talking about to know here, theorems. Ergodicity we don't know about, because we don't understand the dynamics of the horizon. But anyway, it doesn't look completely wrong in that case. So I just wanted to, this would be, I think, the line that a unitary argument would follow. I just wanted to mention, I think maybe one could draw certain kinds of conclusions from this. For example, suppose you believe that the black hole should be described as a bunch of D-brains or some generalized thing. Then you might expect to see that as you turn up the coupling and make it come closer and closer to having a horizon, you might expect to see something like the D-brains migrating toward the horizon area, if they're going to ultimately be in relative degrees of freedom. So there are hints that one could look for this theory being working out. So that's that takes care of thesis 4 and 5. It takes care of thesis 4. So thesis 5, I haven't yet stated. And that's the assumption, that's the statement that in fact, this is not going to work in the end. this is probably the most controversial statement, that this is not going to work because, although it's internally a consistent idea, it seems to be contradicted by the semi-classical, what we understand semi-classical. That seems to be contradicted by what we understand about the semi-classical character of the Hawking radiation, and that's something you probably have something to say about, which is that if this is really, if we're really to have unitary evolution, then we have to get rid of the entanglement between, so the problem with this view is the a semi-classical picture tells us, as people will be familiar with it, when the black hole radiates, you get sort of coupled modes forming, they're sort of created just inside, just outside the horizon, and then one falls into the singularity, and one propagates up to infinity, and becomes the quantum of the Hawking radiation. So I just call them A and A bars. And these, according to the semi-classical picture, they're created in an entangled state. And so as time goes on, you get more and more of these entangled pairs. And this is happening in a regime where we don't have good reason to doubt the semi-classical picture because curvatures are all very low. And there may be subtle loopholes, but this is the argument. Well, once you have all these entanglements between A and A bar, then there's no way to get rid of them. There's no way to undo them without having information come out from deep inside the interior of the black hole to outside. So if you trace these out or neglect these, then you just have a mixed state here, and you can't have unitary evolution. So this entanglement, which we could also call dissipation, because it represents an increase in entropy of the external region, would have to be erased somehow in order to overcome this problem. That looks to me like this most serious problem. The horizon really is, in some way, dissipated. It really does have a loss of unitarity associated with the Hawking radiation, and therefore it can't be described by entropy increase can't be described by some argument from unitarity. So, on this point of view, the black hole is not just an ordinary thermodynamic system. It's thermodynamic in many respects, but it's a little bit different from the other ones because of this essential non-unitarity, which is coming, if you like, from coarse graining and neglecting what's outside the black hole. So, my sixth thesis, I'll just try and rush a little bit, is that this non-unitarity is to be welcome, not abhorred, and because it leads to a very nice kind of proof of the generalized second law. Try and rush through this. So, if we assume the following things, we get proof. So here's a sketch of how the second proof of the second law will go. If we really accept this non-unitarity, I'll make several assumptions. These would have to be justified by the deeper quantum theory. Ultimately, the first one is that there's some effective density matrix rho hat, which is well defined and describes the situation outside the black hole horizon, say on some hypersystems whose definition we can talk about on how we locate the horizon. The second assumption is that this is not only defined, but that it has an autonomous evolution. In other words, you don't need to know what's inside the black hole to know how this evolves. This is, if you like, almost a definition of a black hole. The next assumption is that the entropy, or the total, this is for the entropy we're interested in is wrap bubble. If the total entropy is traced from the line from that inverse, the usual formula in terms of this. The next assumption, this is important, is that there exists an operator E hat, the total energy operator, defined at infinity, or at the boundary of the box in which the black hole. And it should have the property that the evolution, this evolution of the density matrix, should have the property that if I choose rho hat to be a step function, some E naught, that is to say, it's just the uniform distribution of all energies less, overall energies less than E naught, because it's the step function. But that's preserved. If you like, this is a kind of conservation of energy, but the specific thing we need is not that E hat itself be preserved, but that this particular combination be preserved. And then, finally, we'll assume that the dimension of the Hilbert space corresponding to the energies less than E is finite. This is meant to be a consequence of the discreteness of the underlying discreteness, and of course also to make it finite, we have to put it in put the whole thing in the box. And if we accept all of these things, and just by a fairly simple theorem you can prove about the properties of evolutions, the so-called unital evolutions, that preserve density, this kind of density matrix. It follows that, so we said here that if you choose this particular density matrix, it's preserved with time. Now let's choose an arbitrary density matrix and ask what the evolution does to it. It turns out that it's non-decreasing. So that's the theorem. So this is the idea, this is how you would prove the generalized second law from this point of view. It proves what we want if one other thing is true. So this, it proves the generalized second law if it's right in the sense that it proves that something is non-decreasing. But we want that thing to be the right thing. So it has to be, so it has to be that the total entropy defined in this way splits up as a sum of something proportional to the area plus something that's just the usual kind of matter entropy of the surroundings. So that's the other thing.
Where did the non-unitarity come in?
Sorry?
Where
the non-unitarity was crucial because I didn't assume non-unitarity, but this would be everything I said here would be right if there was unitary evolution. But then this increasing would become inequality. In other words, the entropy would never change if I defined it this way.
Yeah, could the coarse graining involved just be one that you do by choice rather than one that happens physically? Isn't that sort of
the usual story?
That's how we usually talk about it.
Yes, right. So you're right. Yeah. So this.
There doesn't seem to need in the miniature.
Well, but if you want. So if you take the unitary point of view, then you can still get non-unitarity by coarse graining. That's what usually happens.
Yes.
If you do it appropriately of not coarse graining, then you get an effective evolution, and that's non-unitary.
Yeah.
So in order to see the entropy actually increase, in order to see real dissipation, you do need some form of non-unitarity. The question is it a fundamental non-unitarity? Or is it just something that's an approximation?
You're not saying which one of those you...
Well, I'm saying that it's fundamental. Yeah, I have it. You're right. Okay, you pin me down. I personally believe that quantum gravity cannot be unitary at all for many reasons. So I think it's a fundamental non-unitarity. But you could take the point of view here that there's still some sort of global unitarity, and that what we've done is a particular kind of coarse graining, and I meant to say this, as I expressed before, which is particularly natural that's available to us in the case of the black hole that's not available in other cases, which is coarse graining by the black thinking in series.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very sort of objective form
of coarse graining. Or it could be coarse graining by insisting on a semi-classical description of the John Deere.
Well, that would be this viewpoint, right? So that the microscopic view, which I argue, this is I can't give a strong argument against this, except the only argument is this need to erase the entanglement, which looks to be impossible. But aside from that, this looks like a very coherent view itself. The only thing I would say is that if you adopt that view, you really will end up being forced to look at the degrees of freedom on the horizon, as opposed to inside. Of course, I didn't talk about anything like holography when there may be an ambiguity, whether they're inside. I'm just leaving that aside. But insofar as the distinction makes sense, I would say that they have to be located on the horizon.
Can I ask for the picture you drew in number 4 up there? To get that Friedman universe to join up with the outside of the black hole, you can do that with the stress energy tensor satisfying the usual positivity conditions everywhere.
Yeah, this is literally the Friedman solution. It's a spherical.
So at the neck of
K equals plus one Friedman solution.
There are no violations of energy conditions.
Nothing.
Where do you glue it?
So, well, here, anywhere along here. So it looks like a sphere, but. So this is an embedding diagram, that describes a black hole. This is one asymptotic region. This is this road here. This would have been, if I didn't glue anything in, the other asymptotic region. And then I'm taking that on one hand, and then just the spherical Friedman. This is a momentary time slice of the spherical Friedman universe. And I cut off part of this. And I cut off part of this, and I glue them together, and the matching can be done. This was the, I think, the original solution that was found in the Einstein equations, where one actually saw a form of gravitational collapse, if I'm not mistaken.
So how does this connect to some statement I often hear that if you want to make a bubble, if you want to make a baby universe or something at the neck, you need to have a violation of the stress energy property somewhere.
If you want to make a what?
A baby universe.
Oh,
so okay, you can get that from any initial condition, from any.
That's right. Yeah. So this is a possible state. That's right.
Right.
And if you trace it back, it doesn't look like a collapsing black hole. It's a light hole or something.
Right. Because unless you match them across a zero momentum surface where the extremely curvature is zero, the emission will have a little jerk where you need to have a vanish.
Well, this is you can momentarily match it, but it's data, and you can evolve it forward and backward. And you actually,
the Friedman
universe does what it does. I mean,
so
the equations are local.
So it is a moment of time.
Well, as I drew it, it's a moment of time. But the matching continues to work for all time.
It won't remain a Friedman universe. It will become a GES.
I think it'll remain a Friedman universe. But it'll just collapse down what a Friedman universe does if you follow it. This is the moment of maximum expansion of the Friedman universe. And then it'll just collapse down to the usual cosmological singularity, and that'll correspond, that'll sort of patch on, if you like, to the Schwarzschild singularity.
But maybe what Samir's getting at is if I go to the other side, what I have is an eternal black hole. I mean, it's a black hole that was always there.
Yes, that's right.
It's not something I can create.
Oh, I see. Okay, this is only for the internal one. I understand.
Outside, it looks like an internal.
Okay, so for a collapsing hole, you can't make a baby universe without wanting stress energy still.
Well, and this is not making it. Yes, that's it. But my point was that this is available to the phase space if we imagine an internal equilibrium. There's no reason that we have to rule out this as a possible state. Of course, I don't think equilibrium is probably not a good description of the interior, but it needs to be if this other trend of proof was to go through successful. Okay, so this is right.
You don't accept you could rule it out because it couldn't possibly be. That state couldn't be reached from
there. That's not, that's of course, yeah, so there's another, that's of course, the, all of these things have other alleyways and byways. So you could try and change the rules and say there are some states that are not acceptable
right.
if they had a white hole, for example, and which in some sense this did, if we could figure out what it means for a state to have had a white hole, we could impose that restriction and rule it out. Maybe we could change this. Absolutely.
Could you just elaborate this argument against the semi-classical?
So this is just the question that people often talk about, the return. It's just a particular way of putting this question that people often raise about the return of unitarity, the return of correlations. Everyone agrees, of course, this is just coming out of the calculation, that you produce these entangled pairs, one of which in the classical picture falls into the singularity and the other one appears at infinity. And then people say, well, but the effect of state for the external pairs, because of the entanglement, is just some sort of mixed state. And if that would be all that was left when the black hole disappeared, then we would have a non-unitary outcome of the evaporation. So there's some need to introduce, to purify the state. People try to do it by making correlations appear between these different quantities, the ones emitted earlier and the ones emitted later. But my point is, it's not enough to make these correlations appear. You have to get rid of the correlations with these lost quanta. And that looks much harder, because they're not things that you can do by fiddling around. They seem, at least, not to be things you can do by fiddling around with what's happening at the horizon. You have to somehow dig deep inside there and pull this information out somehow. So as long as these things, as long as there's an entanglement that remains, it doesn't matter what subtle effects you do that introduce new correlations among the quanta that go out to infinity. You'll still have a mixed state. That's all. It's a very elementary point, but maybe not as stressed all the time.
Yeah, although it's basically Hawking's argument. But at that point, if you make those indoid particles seem like real particles, from the perspective of the outside perspective, then you're sort of undermining sort of the microphysical interpretation of the entropy. Right? It seems like it.
Why?
Because once you have this non-unitary entropy, why would the total number of microstates of the black hole, why wouldn't it keep growing in time?
Well, it might inside. Who knows what will happen? You might have a baby universe that expands into some giant thing. My claim is that the entropy we're interested in is the entropy that resides on the horizon.
Yeah, so what you're saying.
In fact, this entanglement is good for that, right? Because it's impossible. I mean, I wasn't going to discuss this, but of course, you can compute the shape of graviton or any other linear field that lives in the neighborhood of the horizon. You can compute the entanglement entropy due to that, and you find something that without. In the semi-classical calculation, and you find something that without any cutoff is infinite, but if you put a cutoff at about the Planck scale, you get something just the right order of magnitude.
Yeah, so you're then proposing an interpretation of the entropy as purely entanglement entropy rather than a measure of the number of states.
Well, to me, they're the same thing. Yeah, and that is what we mean by the states in the world. Well, I'm not saying it's purely entanglement, but that would give me my next point. So what are the entanglement is one contribution. My personal favorite is, of course, that it's really a measure of the microstates, and the microstates really have to come from a deeper theory. We can't understand them in this continuum approximation. To me, there's some sort of, you might call causal set molecule, molecularist. Anyway, I don't want to go into that. But that's the deep meaning, but there could be an effective description of them. Part of the answer for the entanglement. My personal favorite is shapes. I think it's small fluctuations in the shape of the horizon, which ought to be thought of as in the effective continuum description as representing the states of the black hole that are summarized in the entropy form.
In that case, shouldn't you have found them in as hair for the graviton mode?
Not classically, right? So these are quantum fluctuations. In fact, you can do, you're making me sound like I was going to leave out to save time. As long as people are happy, as long as the chair is happy.
I'm going to become more chair-like. 30 seconds.
for me, maybe I should just continue and come back to that question here.
Well, actually, yeah, I don't know where we're at, number 7 out of 10, but if so that things don't get completely out of whack, if we break for coffee at 10:30, that would be
okay. What 6 was that there exists a semi-classical version of this proof that I just found. I don't know where it was. This proof here has a semi-classical version. And I'll just write the formula. And this I want to pose as a problem to make this rigorous. I'm sure it could be made rigorous. It's only semi-rigorous. You show that the basically, for those who know about relative entropy and quantum mechanics, the free energy, here we're dealing with absolute entropy. If we take the relative entropy between the actual state and the thermal state, we get what's called the relative entropy, and that's what's known as free energy. And so what this shows is that the free energy is non, in this case because of the sign, non-increasing. Not increasing. And if you translate that, here you have to make another assumption, which is called complete positivity of the evolution. You find this inequality that can be semi-classically, this is just a general inequality for field, any fields whatsoever propagating in the background of the black hole. Then using the semi-classical equations, we equate this to minus ds, the first law of the black hole, using a sort of assuming quasi-stationary evolution of the black hole, and then it follows the ds. This total was actually, I wrote total, I shouldn't have written total, I meant external. This is all for the external fields. So the ds external plus ds black hole then would be greater than or equal to zero. So this proof, if it were made fully rigorous, would cover essentially all the Dedekind experiments that people have talked about for proving the generalized second law. I just want to mention that and raise it as an interesting problem for people to prove.
I don't know if that's the mystery of entropy increase in the sense that anything you do on the basis of physical laws, like number 6, is always going to lead to an entropy increase in that sense. Because, I mean, as just pointed out, either the laws are unitary or they're entropy increasing fundamentally. The mystery is, if there is a mystery, is it ascribing the entropy of the black hole as the area? Then it becomes a bit more non-trivial as to why.
Right, so this is bypassing the mystery. I'm just invoking this first. This is a semi-classical or quasi-static treatment. So this is just, you're allowing whatever is outside the black hole to be completely general quantum. We're assuming that the black hole evolves slowly in just such a way, and I took a spherical black hole here, in just such a way as to conserve energy. That's all we're doing. So the mystery of why the entropy is this is not being addressed by this derivation. It's just saying that if we define the entropy this way, we prove the second law in the semi-classical situation.
And I guess I might be saying that. I mean, if you say that there's a mystery to the generalized second law, I think I'm not sure that there is one. If you go with Bill and Bob and say, I mean, once you believe with Bill and Bob, then there's no mystery to the second law, right? The generalized second law, because
no, there is. Someone
well,
they're not deriving it. They're just saying if we assume it's true, we don't need. I'm not sure what we're thinking of, but if it's this controversy over the entropy bounds, they're just saying it can be true even without entropy bounds.
That's right.
But they're not showing why it's there. There's still a mystery. Why is there a generalized second law?
Well, I think they are, because they're saying that if, as long as you specify how the black hole interacts with thermal radiation, then that's the end of the story. You don't need to have any.
Well, that's a quality, but that's something
that's
a classical argument. In fact, that's what I'm saying here is a form of that. This is a completely general form of a semi-classical derivation, quasi-stationary for the black hole of the second law. Anyway, let me So this is the last one that I'll write down. The entropy would be infinite without a cutoff. And this is based on just thinking about what might in fact be contributing the entropy. We have these degrees of freedom. So we make a list and we look at them and we see that each of them plausibly is infinite without a cutoff. Some of them are by definition cutoff because they have three degrees of freedom. But if we look in the effective description, so what could it be? The shapes of the black hole, maybe there's an important role for the quasi-normal modes here. Because this is the thing that I sort of suppressed saying before, controlled myself not to say, which is that there's good evidence for a fractal structure of the horizon below a certain light scale, which may be something like n to the 1 through, from different kinds of argument. If that's there, then there's a general. And so the question is that there? And this would be, so this would be visible in a continuum analysis. Another thing is near horizon modes of other fields or gravitons, if you like. Just in the linear ends. This is the entanglement entropy. If we take the non-unitary, so here's another place where the non-unitary is. If we take the non-unitary view, this is just entanglement entropy. If we take the unitary view, we have to think, I'm not sure it makes sense to talk about this entanglement entropy. But maybe you can do some kind of coarse graining to get a similar result. And then another thing would be that people have modes of some new field that's associated with the horizon itself. So, for example, Hollandheimer and Kohler, some sort of Chern-Simons field, for example, and also Steve Carlin has done a lot of other things like this. And I think in loop quantum gravity, some things come out. And then finally, states, if that's the word, of some deeper theory. Could be strings or other objects in string theory. It could be loops, loop quantum gravity, and it could be, I'll just say this without trying to define it, causal diamonds in causal set theory. So I guess I don't have enough time to talk about any of these in any detail, but if you look at this, for each one, well, this one anyway is discrete in its very nature, so we don't have to argue with the question. And for these others, especially these three, I think you can make arguments that without putting some sort of cutoff on these modes, you get an infinite. For example, the number of shape fluctuations, if you have a fractal structure going down to zero size, you seem to have an infinite entropy. But in all of these, they all have a general character that if you put a cutoff at around the plot length, then they're all going to give roughly the right order of things because of the way that they're localized in the nature of the horizon. Particularly, that's been proved in some rigor with the case of the entanglement. So that, I guess I just better. I think I better stop here. I have a long list of interesting problems.
Okay, well, maybe
once I make in.
Maybe we can save those for the discussion sessions because I really let things run over.
Yeah.
But that was my fault for asking for the introduction. So let's thank Raphael first. Let's take a 15-minute break, but then be back here at 11:15. And so coffee is upstairs in the bistro where we were this morning.